religion, dogma, document that has the right to question our divinity because of who we are, who we love, how we show up. That is not between us and mortal people. That is between us and what we believe. Yeah, it is. And so what my invitation to you would be is remember your lovability, your creativity, or your divinity. Those things are a part of our inherent worth. We are inherently lovable. We are inherently holy, and we are inherently creative. And people can't take that away from us. It's who we are. So thank y'all so much. We're going to be back. I'm just going to give you a warning. Tammy asks the hardest questions of anybody I've ever sat down with in my career. They're always great questions, but they're hard. So come back and hear Tammy ask awesome questions and me do fun things to buy time as I think of answers.
Continues with session 3, a question and answer session with Brené Brown that I had the honor of hosting.
Well, as everyone is streaming in and taking their seats, I'd like to thank everyone for your very good questions. There were definitely some themes that emerged, and I'll try to bring those themes up as well as incorporating some of the actual questions. Ready to go?
I'm ready.
Okay. Rising strong as a spiritual practice. I want to start talking a little bit about that. And I was very intrigued and interested in your definition of spirituality and how you emphasized this sense of appreciating our interconnection and also this sense of feeling grounded in love and belonging. And what I'd like to know is more explicitly how, as I engage in the rising strong process, how does this lead to feeling interconnected and especially feeling like I belong? If you can just connect those dots for me and make it really explicit.
Yes. So I think rising strong as a spiritual practice is really about, if you think of every part, the reckoning, the rumble, and the revolution, especially when you get into the rumble, the question is, what more do I need to know about myself? What more do I need to know about the other people in here? What do I need to understand about myself? What do I need to understand about my intentions and the intentions of other people? And so what I think the Rising Strong process forces us to do is to look at the story we're making up in the context of relationship with other people. This is not just, I may be the only person going through this, but this is about my connection with other people. This is not just about me. It's about how Steve is showing up, how I'm showing up, whether I'm blaming him, what I'm doing. And so what it really does, I think, is it's a reminder that we're all in this together, and all of those things that make us feel alone and isolated are shared human experiences. And so I think even very specifically the rumble questions, which if you, in the book, you know, you can see the questions are, what more do I need to understand and know about myself? What more do I need to understand and know about the people involved? And so I don't think you can escape connection when you're doing this process.
And then this beautiful word, belonging. Somebody wrote in, it's a beautiful word. Somebody wrote in, I don't feel a sense of belonging. I feel very alone. I feel like an outlier. How could I use the Rising Strong process to help me in my sense of not belonging?
Let's start with what gets in the way of belonging. The number one barrier to belonging is fitting in.
Yeah.
And so fitting in is assessing situations and acclimating. Belonging is being who you are and showing up as yourself. And it's riskier. Belonging is riskier because when you show up as yourself, sometimes there's not the connection and sometimes there is. And so I think a lot of times when we struggle with a sense of belonging, sometimes what we're really missing is the way we connect in a belonging way often has to do with shared purpose, shared perspective. And sometimes when we're not clear on our purpose, it's very hard to find belonging. Belonging is not like a crew of friends, like in the commercials, like the beer commercials. There are a lot of breweries here.
There are, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I noticed it while I was driving. It's not like in the beer commercials where belonging is six or seven really fun friends that are with you. If you have one or two people in your life who see you and know you, and you see them and know them, that's a miracle. That's a big deal. It is not a whole bunch of people. And I think there's so much mythology around belonging. And the other thing is, the people with whom we feel a sense of belonging, we have to love the same things. We don't have to like the same movies and like the same colors, but we have to be brought together by a sense of love and a sense of connection. We can't be brought together because we hate the same people. Because, you know, like one of the things I'm really looking at is a lot of false sense of belonging in even faith communities is we are willing to comply with the same rules and willing to hate the same people. And to me, like, I don't call that belonging. I call that common enemy intimacy. Yeah. It's like our intimacy with each other is just because we have the same hatred for the same people. So belonging is really, it's powerful. It is DNA. It is that yearning to be a part of something bigger than us, to have a tribe. And the reason I love the word and hate the word tribe is tribe speaks to us in a very
tribal way.
Tribal way. Yeah. An anthropological way.
Yeah.
But I don't like it because it also, the picture I picture is 100 people. And maybe we're a tribe of two.
Yeah. I notice when I relax when you say that. Yeah. When it's only one or two.
Yeah. It's only one or two. Like, yeah. And it's what, you know, you want to tell you about something that was really hard that I learned when I was doing the belonging research. I think I actually write about this in The Gifts of Imperfection, but it was, I was trying to figure out who could I talk to about belonging that would really get belonging. So I did focus groups with middle school students.
Interesting.
Ooh. Because I like the Minions. Oh. I like it. So I went and said, what do y'all think the difference is between belonging and fitting in? Or do you think they're the same thing? And the kids are just like, they knew. They're like, oh no, ma'am, the miss, that's what they call it. Miss fitting in is when you want to be a part of something, but they don't want you. Belonging is when you want to be a part of something and they want you to be a part of it. You know, belonging is when I can be myself. They gave me all this great insight. And then one of them started this cascade of grief by saying, not belonging at school is hard, but what's really hard, miss, is when you don't belong at home. And then all the kids started just piling on and saying, yeah, not belonging at home is the hardest. And I'm like, tell me what it means to not belong at home. And then they had so many different examples. Well, my parents both got really good grades and my dad was the captain of the football team and my mom was the cheerleader and that's just not my thing. And I'm not very popular and it's really hard for my parents that I'm not popular. It's really hard for my mom that I didn't have a date to homecoming last year. And then you've got kids that are like, I'm an athlete. My parents think that only dumb kids are athletes, or this whole sense that I don't belong at home. And so I was trying to figure out what are the big barriers to belonging at home. And I think one of the biggest barriers to belonging at home are parents who think cool is important. Parents who are like, it's really important to me that you're liked, that you're popular, and that you're cool. And so I need you to play on the football team or I need you to be popular, as opposed to my job is to help you find belonging. And if that is like your president of the Klingon club or the Harry Potter club or, you know, or whatever it is, it doesn't matter, but that you have a group of people that you can show up and be seen by. So belonging is.
Now you made this interesting comment. In true belonging, there is dissent. There's the openness to dissent. That really got my attention. Tell me about that.
It's the big finding that may or may not be in.
That's
book
right.
I may or may not be writing.
Well, it really got my attention.
It's be wary of any place or any person who's peddling belonging that doesn't allow you to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you've moved over to fundamentalism at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not allowed to critically think and disagree and challenge and question the norms and values of a group, then you don't really ever belong to that group. You may be a part of that group, but your membership is tenuous.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason it really got my attention is that it seems in our world today, it's so important for people to rise strong and be willing to speak truth to power, even that phrase, speak truth to power, even if it risks mm-hmm. them being exiled or kicked out of the group, whether that's where you work or mm-hmm. your group of friends or anything, that you have to be able to do that. And in some ways that is, you know, this rising strong. We have to be able to do that. And for some people it could risk their sense of belonging, but you're saying, no, that's not real belonging.
That's not real belonging. That's why there are different moments in our lives. Like I've been thinking a lot about moments, memories, and membership, and how those are very different things. Like, there are moments where I feel a deep, so I'm a huge football fan.
Okay.
Really love college football. You know, Texas, Alabama fan. And I was recently at the College Football Hall of Fame, because that's what I do in my spare time. But I was actually there studying belonging, because they have this incredible video. They show, like, all the pregame stuff, tailgating, the parties, all the traditions of the teams running out, and the touchstones and everything. And, of course, I'm weeping, and, like, this is beautiful. And I think about those moments where it's almost like being at church and going to the rail with people you want to punch. In those moments, we are a part of something together. And we have our jerseys on, and we're yelling, and we feel so close. And we're brought together by a sense of something good and joyful. Is that really true belonging? I don't know the answer to that yet. TBD.
Mm-hmm.
As long as that thing is rooted in goodness and joy and love, the tolerance for dissent is high. But the minute, because you know those sporting events and that stuff have dark sides, right? And the minute it changes, and the minute our collective becomes about race, or our collective becomes about gender, or something, we're not brought together anymore by something positive or good. We're brought to something hateful, and that's when things get violent and hard. And so I'm still trying to figure out the difference between kind of shoulder to shoulder with like-spirited people, those incredible moments. And they're big. Like, have y'all ever experienced that? Like in a sport game or a concert when you're sitting with people and you all share this love for this thing. It's so powerful and you belong and you feel like I'm one of these things. And that's not to be discounted. But we do it a lot more these days in the last 2 years, 3 years, where the rallying cry is shared hate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm still trying to figure that out. There's something important there that I'm trying to get to.
Now, in talking about rising strong as a spiritual practice, you talked about how practicing spirituality brings a sense of perspective, meaning, and purpose.
Yes.
And I could see in your elucidation of rising strong the perspective piece. We get all kinds of perspective on ourselves, on other people, on what's motivating
yes.
us. The meaning and purpose was not as clear to me. How, by rising strong, I'm going to find meaning and purpose in my life.
I can give you a great example. So I'm sure it was not hard for y'all to figure out, like, the common denominators in my SFDs from both my stories.
Yeah.
I say yes, then I resent and hate you. And then I don't have boundaries. And then I'm not generous towards you. And I become bitter and resentful. And if you looked at all my SFDs over the last 2 or 3 years, you would see a plot line that needs to be retired for sure. And it has given me a very strong sense of purpose that I totally believe that we are called to do something during our time here and that we all have very unique contributions that we need to make, and to not make them does not go unnoticed. Or I think there are penalties for not making the contributions that you were brought here to make.
Penalties.
Penalties.
Football term. What does that mean though here? I mean, that's
holding.
Holding. Mm-hmm. 10 yards back.
Yes, I had to give up football metaphors for Lent this year.
Were you successful?
I was pretty successful, but it was really hard, and it left me stumped a couple times. I couldn't articulate things I wanted to say. I think we do pay a penalty when we don't really act on our gifts. And I think it's part of the midlife thing. I think midlife is when the universe comes and grabs you by the shoulders and says, I'm not screwing around. Like, you're halfway to dead, right? And all the armor that you put on yourself to protect yourself is getting in the way of you growing into your gifts. You have work to do here, and you need to do it. And so my armor is and was perfectionism and being the good girl and not disappointing people. I think I can stay safer when I don't disappoint people. And so for me, reading those SFDs and going through this process and seeing the same thing show up over and over again, what I realized is I cannot act on my, part of my purpose is getting clear about what my contribution is and saying no every time a request does not align with what I think I'm supposed to be doing. Because every time I say yes to something, it is a no to something else.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, part of my purpose is, the perspective it gives me is the SFD and the rumble. The purpose Rising Strong process brings to me is very much what keeps coming up. What is it the universe is going to keep laying at your feet until you pick it up, dust it off, embrace it, understand that you've got to change it, and do that work. And meaning for me is, I have been able to assign so much meaning to behaviors that I engage in and decisions I make because of this process. Like the resentment versus discomfort. Like that has so much meaning in my life now because I understand that I was not put here to make people comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my job. Yeah, and I don't think I can actually act on the purpose, like a really divine purpose that I think we all have. I cannot act on that and keep everybody happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, Rising Strong as a spiritual practice has definitely been perspective and purpose and meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't get to it until I could get to those stories.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the sense of purpose is even just the next thing. It's like right in front of you, the next thing.
Yeah. I'm doing big purpose work right now. And I think that's like, I am here to do this. But purpose to me, way out there,
mm-hmm.
I was going to say on the 50-yard line, but way out there when you're standing here is not helpful. I need to be reminded of my purpose today, tonight. I need that reminder. And I think that's why it's a spiritual practice.
Yeah.
Like basketball practice. Like something you have to do every day.
Well, and someone asked me about that as a practice. This person wrote in, you know, I'm not looking for a daily planner, but I am looking for a more general outline. Are you recommending that I set aside time to journal every day? How is this a practice? Is it just when it comes up and I feel uncomfortable and I know there's a reckoning? And does that just happen every day because we're emotional beings? Or is there some kind of practice I'm supposed to do?
I think for me, the daily practice
mm-hmm.
of Rising Strong, that's such a good question. I don't think I've ever articulated this way before. I think to me, the daily practice of Rising Strong is a daily awareness of the stories we're telling ourselves. I mean, how many of you honestly tell stories to yourself every day about something that's happening? And so I think Rising Strong as a daily practice is, if journaling helps, that's great. But I would guarantee you, in my office, there are 20 of us. I would guarantee you that the words, well, the story I'm telling myself right now, are spoken 100 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Like we don't have a meeting without saying, you know, the story I'm telling myself right now is we're not answering this question because we don't really care about this project and it's not a priority. Or, well, the story I'm making up is that she's actually really pissed off about what happened yesterday. The story I'm making up is this is not getting done because we haven't trained people properly to do it. So it is the way we talk to each other now. It's the way my kids talk. It's the way Steve and I talk to each other every day. And so I think the daily practice part of Rising Strong is being aware of the cognitive dissonance between what's actually happening and the story we're making up about what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's daily. That's daily.
So let's get into the rising strong process, if you will, and even look under the hood. We can use a truck kind of Texas metaphor, yeah? Hood open.
God,
okay.
Am I that?
No, I'm going to Texas.
Tracks,
okay.
Football. Bear.
And I want to.
I am actually.
Dig in a little bit to how we actually do this, how to make it real in our life. And so we'll start with the reckoning. We're recognizing what we're feeling and we're able to articulate the emotion. And yet what you've told us is that most people can name three emotions and yet we need more like 30 to be emotionally fluent. So that's a big gap in most people's experience. How are we going to address that? How are each one of us going to address that?
Do you see that question? See? Jesse? They're good. They're just, you're on fleek. Questions are on fleek. Okay. So my daughter says, I think it's good. Okay. So the reckoning, there's two pieces and let's get really clear about what it is because it's not that you have to know exactly what you're feeling. You have to recognize that you're emotionally hooked by something and you have to get curious about what it is. So one of the things that we're doing sooner than later, and we're not going to wait for the next book, is we're going to put out the list of the 30 emotions. We're working on that right now. And Courage Works, we have a parenting class that we're starting in January. And one of the things we're doing in the parenting class, and we've never done this before, which is exciting, is we're actually teaching the basics, shame, love, belonging, compassion, empathy, and emotion. And so we've got the list and we're going to teach parents the list and then we're going to teach parents how to teach their children the list. Mm-hmm. Whether their kids are 4, 14, or 44. And so we're going to come out with that list. I think there are a lot of ways to do it, to learn those emotions. So the way that we're recommending is we're really recommending creativity, a creativity project. And I know that freaks people out because of all the art scars we all have, right? But one of the big findings from Rising Strong that I haven't done very much with yet, and it was really interesting because a lot of people thought it was going to be the big finding, was that I had this question, and I know it's such a Tammy Simon question, because the question is, how do people move information from their head to their heart so it becomes a practice? Mm-hmm. Like, you're big on that question, right?
Make it real.
Make it real. You know what the answer was? Creativity.
Interesting.
The majority of people who can really, what we call embed knowledge, so that it becomes a practice, use some kind of creative means, whether it's writing, painting, whatever it is. I think the way we move information from our heads to our hearts is through our hands. And so we're doing an entire creative class. So one of the things that we're doing is we're asking people to get their cameras out and take 30 pictures of their face representing each of the affects.
Cool.
You know, so like for me, and we have the iceberg, which is a huge part that I didn't talk about today, which I think is fascinating because one of the problems that keeps people from recognizing emotion is that the power of pissed off and shut down. Mm-hmm. So that's like an iceberg. So what you see behaviorally is you see someone angry or shut down.
Yeah.
And there are about 15 emotions that behaviorally show up as anger or shut down. So we talk about what those are as well. And we encourage people to do them with their kids. And so I even have a clip from me and Charlie when Charlie was 3, when I was sitting with him and I was like, cause you know, pediatrician, social worker, all you therapists out there, my kids will be coming any moment. But we said, you know, with our kids, both of them since they were little, show me your angry face, show me your scared face, show me your frustrated face. And we did that with our kids, like most parents do, like, what does a cow say? You know, we did that too, but we also did that. And so both of our kids have really big emotional vocabularies. So they have that emotional granularity. So they may shut down or get angry, but we'll say what's underneath it. Ellen might say, I think it's regret. So it is completely teachable. If we open the hood under the first part of the process of the reckoning, the two big pieces that are hard, recognizing you've been hooked by something. And we asked the audience, how do you know you're hooked? And they gave us tons of physiological symptoms, heart racing. A lot of people do the loop. How many of you get something on a loop and just keep playing it in your head? You recognize that you're in it, and then you get curious about it. The hard thing about curiosity is curiosity was drilled out of most of us growing up.
Mm.
And so curiosity is this amazing, beautiful emotion, one of the big 30. But most of us were really, either subtly or not so subtly, kind of beat down about being too curious. How many of y'all had that response of, don't ask too many questions? Right. So it's a lot of us. It's most of us. And what's interesting is Lowenstein, he's a researcher and he studies curiosity. This, I think, is fascinating. Some amount of knowledge must exist for curiosity to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
But it's also counterintuitive, don't you think? Like, we in schools expect children to have curiosity about things they don't know about. But they don't. And so people aren't curious about emotion because they've had no primer on emotion at all.
Yeah.
So why would they be curious about it? It's like, why would I be curious about astrophysics?
Yeah. You don't even know what questions to ask.
I wouldn't even know, I wouldn't even know that's something I'm supposed to be thinking about.
Yeah.
So I think the reckoning is really, to me, there's been a lot of debate about this from other scholars who are using my work now and testing it quantitatively. I think that the hardest part of this process is the reckoning. The willingness to acknowledge that you're triggered by something, emotion has you, and to get curious about what it is exactly you're feeling.
You talked about how you trained yourself to wait at least 8 to 10 seconds mm-hmm. with discomfort.
Yes.
To be with the discomfort of a difficult emotion. Maybe the sense that you're disappointing
yeah.
someone or something like that. Terrible. Yeah. A lot of people can't stay with discomfort. They don't stay with discomfort. And, you know, the quick open the refrigerator, check my iPhone immediately, call a friend, do something. I mean, all of our addictive behaviors, I think, often stem from, I'm uncomfortable, bam, addiction, bam, 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 go to it. So that aspect, I think, really needs to be looked at under a magnifying glass. How do people stay long enough with discomfort to even start teasing it apart? What is this?
I have a note in a pantry.
Mm-hmm.
I could do.
Okay. What does your note say?
Why are you here? Yeah. It just says, why are you here? Because I say, oh, because I'm hungry. Then okay. But, you know, we end up in the pantry without even realizing how we got there. And
yeah.
then, you know, my go-to would be carbs. I think I look for the exit ramp out of discomfort as well. So I guess there's this super, I don't know, Dalai Lama approach to discomfort, which would be, I feel it, I embrace it, I stay in it. That's not me.
Okay.
So then there would be like the Brené Brown approach, which would be, I feel it, I want out, I'm trying to get out, there's a frickin' post-it note. Okay, oh yeah, I know what this is, stay in it. And that's my top goal. I'm not reaching higher than that. I feel like I've arrived at my most excellent self. It's not that I don't want to aim higher, it's just, for me, I've come a long way. So I admire and respect the people that can feel discomfort, recognize it, and stay in it, and love on it. I am not that person. And so I think that we have to do is find a way, a physical, tangible way to acknowledge I'm uncomfortable. Okay, I'm going to tell you what I use.
Please, because I don't think people are naturally drawn necessarily to the I love it and I'm going to stay with it for a long time.
Yeah. So because I do a lot of work with special forces in the military, I spend a lot of time with those men and women, and they've taught me this thing about embracing the suck. Do y'all know this?
No.
So what they say is, so the first time I did something with the military, I was going to do this big training for a group of veterans, and they said, great, we're going to do the training, it'll be all day, and then we're going to celebrate at the end of the day with a 5K. It's like, oh, great. super cool. And so I start running, and I'm getting ready for this 5K, and I make my sister do it with me. And so we're running, and I like call Mike Irwin, who's still at West Point at this point. I'm like, oh, my God, I just can't get past a mile. And, you know, and he's talking to me about techniques, and he's like, oh, yeah, this is not about technique. He's like, you just got to embrace the suck. And I was like, what do you mean? He says, embrace the suck. Yeah, it sucks. It's part of it. I was like, okay. And so I learned how to embrace the suck. I think when I'm in that uncertainty, I just say out loud, embrace the suck.
I don't think that'll be a good book title, incidentally.
No, just, I don't think that's...
Just leave that one.
No, it's not. It's a terrible. Yeah. It's a terrible book title.
Yeah,
I could think. I could say some really terrible, funny subtitles right now, but I won't.
Yeah.
But I think, to me, what that does, it's actually neurobiologically brilliant, and I'll tell you why. Because you're naming that you're in discomfort. So you're staying prefrontal cortex and you're not letting that limbic system go, okay, now what's happening right now? And like soothe, fight, what do you want to do? You're just saying embracing the suck. This is uncomfortable right now. And sometimes I'll just say embrace the suck, embrace the suck, embrace the suck, embrace the suck. And you don't have to do it for very long. And then I can get to this place where that stuff is kind of a wave. You know, discomfort's a wave, right? And so, like, I'll give you a great example. My daughter's applying for college right now. She's a senior in high school. This is hard for me. And I was supposed to meet with her and do some stuff. So we sat down. I said, okay, let me see everything you did. Let me check it for you. And she's like, I haven't written these two pieces. I'm like, why not? And she said, well, I thought that's where we were going to meet and we were going to brainstorm. And I was like, well, Ellen, as you can see, I've already completed college. So I don't know why this is my responsibility, and, you know, if this is not important to you, it's sure as hell not going to be important to me. So she's just amazing, generous, responsible, great person. And I could just see her kind of caving in on herself. And I was so mad. And she's like, I'm really sorry. You know, I'm always trying to be respectful of your time. And I thought we were, you know, and I could tell something was going on. I just walked away. I said, give me a second. And I just stood in my study, which is like 10 feet from my kitchen table. I was like, embrace the suck. Embrace the suck. What is happening? Embrace the suck. Embrace the suck. And I came back out of my study and I just started crying. I said, this is not about you. This is about me. And this is exactly what we said we were going to do together. And I'm so excited for you. And I have waves of having a really hard time that you're leaving. And so I think that's what's happening for me right now. And she said, oh my God, maybe I'm not ready then. And I said, yeah. And I said, no, you're totally ready. I'm ready. You're ready. We can be ready and it can be hard. And I said, I really apologize. But I just remember standing in my study just saying, embrace the suck, because I was like, you are hooked by something. What is happening? And it's not like I'm like, 1 minute, Ellen. I'm reckoning with my emotion and getting curious about what I'm feeling. You know, it was more like, fuck. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, but it can be really quick. So I think neurobiologically for me, when I start saying embrace the suck over and over, what I'm telling myself is don't talk, text, type, or do anything until you figure out what's going on. Mm. Just stay in the discomfort and figure out what's going on. And it will pass. Mm-hmm. And then you can be your most integrity-bound person.
Now, somebody wrote in about this reckoning question and difficult emotional experience, and they say, I move into paralysis during difficult experiences. Can you help me?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. I mean, some of us freeze, fight, flight, parasympathetically freeze. Some of us freeze. One of the most beautiful ways that I think to talk about this is the Stone Center at Wellesley, whose research I love. Linda Hartling ran a research crew looking at patterned ways that we respond to shame specifically, but I think it's all difficult emotion. And she found that we either move toward, move away, or move against. And I love that she called it strategies of disconnection. Because they're the smart ways we disconnect from discomfort and pain. Mm. They're the ways, I mean, they're strategies. We need those strategies. We especially need those strategies when we're kids and we can't physically protect ourselves or emotionally protect ourselves. As grown-ups, the strategies of disconnection hamper our growth. And so some of us move away. We freeze. We hide. We secret keep. We just are like deer in the headlights. evolutionary. I mean, just like some of us move toward, we people please, talk our way out, hustle our way out, prove, perform, perfect. And then some of us move against, and we use shame and aggression and emotion to fight uncomfortable feelings of shame, aggression, which is what you saw me do with Ellen. I attacked her. And most of us, unfortunately, use that hard one against the people we love the most. And so whether you freeze and become paralyzed, you become combative, you start kissing ass and trying to prove your way out, it's all a response to our discomfort. They're all just different strategies to the same thing. I don't have a way to handle discomfort that keeps me in my integrity. And so for me, this is good. These are really good drilling questions, really under the hood now, because one thing I think we need to give ourselves permission to do is I am not going to do that in front of you. So if I get hooked by emotion and I get really uncomfortable, I am going to have to be alone and probably need 5 or 10 minutes before I'm back on my emotional feet. So I am probably going to excuse myself, run to the restroom, step out of a meeting, unless it's something that I'm kind of used to. But we're emotional beings. People, this is the big mistake we make. We believe that we're thinking, cognitive beings who on occasion feel. We are not. We are emotional beings who on occasion think. When something difficult or vulnerable happens, emotion is completely at the wheel, and cognition and behavior are tied up in the trunk. So emotion drives. And this is not work that I'm sharing here with you because we're a group of like-spirited people who want growth. This is work where I'm being asked to go to places like the White House, the CIA, the military. This is not just about work about personal development. This is about the way we lead people in life and death situations. It's the way we show up at work. It's the way we show up with our families. It's the way we run schools and organizations. We cannot continue to lead in families or in organizations from bullshit narratives that we've made up to protect ourselves. You know, it's getting us in trouble. But to get the thinking stuff back online, you're going to have to be uncomfortable for a little bit.
The next step, so we're moving now into rumbling with whatever this discomfort is. And one person wrote in, you know, I don't really get the shitty first draft. Am I writing my thoughts, my feelings? Is it just a dumping of stream of consciousness? How do I actually do this?
Yes. The answer to that question is yes. Yes, and it's all of it. So some people immediately can go to, oh, I know what my shitty first draft is. My shitty first draft is Tammy and I walked out of a meeting. She shrugged her shoulders at me. Tammy doesn't like me. She doesn't trust me. I'm not good at my job and I'm probably going to lose it. Other people are like, oh my God, I'm hooked by something. I'm embracing that suck Brene talked about. I don't know what's happening. And so we have prompts for people that are basically, what are you feeling? What are you physically feeling? What's the first thing you want to do right now? Scream, yell, hide, blame. What's your body doing right now? What are your thoughts racing around right now? And so that's why when Anne Lamott says on the SFD, let your five-year-old out. If you read my SFDs, they would be all different. And you know an SFD is good if you would be mortified if someone read it. Really. If it's edited and it makes you sound sane, it's not real. Because all of my SFDs are, it's not my fault. I'm better than other people. They suck. It's five. It's like a five-year-old with a foul mouth. That's what mine sound like. So the answer is that unfiltered, unchecked thinking is driving your behavior, whether you write it down or not. So it's not like, hey, if you don't write it down, you're going to respond in a really poised, effective way. It's write it down so you know just how off track you are and where it's coming from. So let's play this through. So Tammy and I are in this meeting. We walk out. I say, great meeting, Tammy. Tammy looks at me and goes, and just keeps walking. How many of you in here are triggered by that? So most, 95% of us, right? And so I go into my office and I'm like, oh my God, she's pissed. What happened? What did I say in that meeting? I'm just doing the thing that every one of us would do. What did I say? What did I do? What did I forget to say? What did I forget to do? She doesn't like me. What's going on? I pick up the phone. Hey, Jenny, it's Brene. What's up with Tammy today? Yes or no, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so now I've ignited the phone tree.
Right, yeah.
Super toxic for organizations. Any organization where you talk about people and not to them, dangerous. So I've ignited the back channel phone tree. What's up with Tammy today? Oh, you haven't seen her? Well, let me just tell you, watch out. Now, Jenny's behavior is going to be weird around you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
For no, again. So I'm like, oh, okay. So let's play a different way. I go into my office and I'm like, okay, what is going on? What is going on? I'm going to call Jenny. No, you know what? Embrace the suck. What is happening here, Brene? You are totally hooked. Okay. Embrace the suck. Embrace the suck. Yeah, I'm fearful. I think I disappointed or pissed her off. I don't know. I'm fearful. Okay. Let me rumble with this for a second. I'm not good at what I do. I pissed her off. I forgot to do something. Okay. You know, Tammy's the kind of person that if you piss her off, she's going to tell you. I don't know. All right. Hey, Tammy, you have a second?
Sure.
We were walking out of the meeting today and I said, have a good day. And I felt like you kind of rolled your eyes at me. Now I'm making up that something happened in the meeting that pissed you off. Are we okay?
You and I are fine. I was worried about something that relates to my elderly mom, actually.
Oh, God, I'm sorry. I know that's tough. Yeah. I really appreciate it. How many of you think she respects me more for checking in with her? The thing is that if you don't stop, embrace the suck for a minute, think about why you're uncomfortable, what's got you hooked, and why you're afraid. There's no way you go from Tammy making a sound or rolling her eyes to, wow, Tammy, you just rolled your eyes at me. We okay? You don't do that because that is based on the assumption that you're thinking in response to that, what just happened. We are not thinking in response to what just happened. We're feeling in response to what just happened. So then if Tammy comes back and says, no, I mean, I loved your answer. No, that wasn't about you. I'm taking care of my mom. Things just got really hard. Then it gives this amazing opportunity for me to say, yes, we've been living that for the last 6 months with my father-in-law. If there's some way I can be supportive, let me know. Mm-hmm. And then I'm walking out and Tammy says, thanks for circling back and checking in. That is a moment of deep connection. Mm-hmm. That is a moment of inextricable connection. Mm-hmm. Because is there anyone in here that has not taken care of a parent or does not fear what that may be like one day? Right. We all know that. Mm-hmm. And if Tammy looks at me and says, yeah, Brene, actually, I was going to talk to you about it later. I am really pissed off about what happened in that meeting. Then I can say, great, let's sit down and talk about it. Mm-hmm. So when you write down that SFD, it's about what are you afraid is happening? What's your fear? What do you think? Who are you mad at? What's got you worried? What do you want to do? And when you write it down and look at it, I cannot tell you the power of writing that down.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, though, that I'm curious about, genuinely, is the insight process. I write my SFD, but on my own, reflecting, is that really true? Am I really going to have these layers and layers of insights that are going to take me to a revolutionary new way of being in the world? I mean, I know in my own life, I go to my therapist. I mean, you talked about your Diana that you went to with your SFD. And that makes sense to me, but I'm wondering, without therapeutic intervention, when you're dealing with really difficult SFDs, how far can people go on their own?
I think it depends. I think therapy is the sharing of SFDs.
That's an interesting definition. Never heard that before.
Yeah, I mean, how many therapists in here would agree that what you hear 90% of the time, a safe place to say, well, yeah, then my husband looked at me and I know what he was thinking. He was thinking, you've gained too much weight and I'm leaving you. And the therapist goes, so is that something you've heard your husband say before? No. So where do you think that comes from? And you're like, well, I don't know. I could tell by the look in his eye. Tell me about the look in his eye. Well, I don't know. I don't know that he's saying that, but I bet, what if he thinks that? Do you think that? You know, that shit is gold. Like that is, can you imagine the men and women who do that? Oh my God. That is inherently subversive. Mm-hmm. That is subversive work. And so I think for me, I can deal with a lot of the SFDs because I have plot lines that come up a lot. SFDs that really scare me. I see my therapist, first of all, a book and a process.
Yeah.
Is never the right intervention for trauma.
Yeah.
And so I think if your story is rooted in trauma, we need help with that. Mm-hmm. Like we're not wired to do that by ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's not how we're set up. We're supposed to be in conversation with someone. So where I really still take my SFDs to someone, to a therapist for help, is when regardless of intellectually knowing that it's not true, I cannot change my behavior around it. Mm-hmm. Like I cannot stop self-protecting.
Yeah.
Even if it's causing, even if it's exacerbating the problem. Or I think sometimes when I write the SFD down, but I rumble with the surface issues and don't get to the grief or the forgiveness or the hard stuff, I have to have help. Mm-hmm. But I think that's so much of what good therapy is about, or good therapist, they hold this incredibly sacred space and we let our 5-year-olds out and we let our fearful people out and we let our angry people out, and a space where we're not going to be judged so that we can get to what's at the bottom of it. So I think most really good therapeutic sessions and that work are rumbles. They are rumbles. What is really happening here? And you can spend the rest of your life tackling this issue. But really what's at the bottom of this shitty first draft that you're telling yourself about your life, your lovability, your marriage, your partnership, who you are, is really way down here. And we're going to have to rumble with shame, grief, trauma, whatever it is. And every therapist I've ever known, and I know a lot of them just because of my work, I think most of them are very hopeful that they are modeling and teaching a process that we can eventually do ourselves and also be able to differentiate when we need help doing it.
I think the Rising Strong process, if it was released in the world, which is I know what your work is to do that, in a broad way, would be so, to use your word, revolutionary, would be incredibly revolutionary. But if in order for most of us to get to the really deep material that's underneath our discomforts, we're going to need help, then that requires a different view of therapy in our culture. So many people, whenever I talk about, they share something, I'm like, that'd be great if you worked with a therapist. Oh, come on, Tammy. The last thing I need to do is go see, you know, I worked with a therapist, it didn't really help me, or I can't afford it. Or, you know, I don't really want to spend a bunch of time talking about, you know, it doesn't go anywhere. And there's just so many, we still don't live, I think, in a culture that says, yes, therapy is what a widespread group of people need to rumble successfully. I don't think we're there at all.
I don't think we're there either. But I also think there are other ways to do it in addition.
So that's what I'm curious about. What are those really?
We have a group. I call them the squad. We have a group of people like trained in my work at the Daring Way. And I think about all the different ways they're taking this material. So some of them are therapists and clinicians and they do individual family couples work, but some of them are doing Rising Strong in classrooms. And some of them are doing Rising Strong at the UN, at the United Nations. And some of them are doing Rising Strong with the military. And some of them are doing Rising Strong with leaders and corporations. So I think that I'm always going to be for normalizing therapeutic intervention and sitting across from people. But I also think a great example is we have seen, it's not new racism, but we've seen a new permission for outward homophobia, racism. I mean, we've just seen this crazy thing in the last couple of years. And then you think about, what is a stereotype? What are the stereotypes that fuel racism? They are shitty first drafts. Mm-hmm. These are things that people make up based on limited information about groups of people. There's a group of people using the Rising Strong process to look at race dialogue, class dialogue. There's room for this process in an individual therapeutic way, but there's also room for this process in organizations, schools, and as a collective to start challenging each other and ourselves about what we're making up to protect ourselves and how those narratives are destroying people's lives. And so I do think that therapy is a solution, but I also see this work on a continuum from micro to macro.
I like it. The cultural revolution aspect. We can high five.
Oh, yeah, for
sure. On the field.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true because stereotypes are shitty first drafts based on what we know. And then we have to rumble and we have to rumble with really hard things. Like the cultural rumble that I would love for people to do right now is the shitty first drafts that I hear people talking about right now about nostalgia. Like, I wish it was like it was back then. Let me translate that for you. You wish it was like it was when people knew their place. Like, let's get clear. So I think that sentence has been in my data for 10 years. It just rose to the top when I was doing Rising Strong research. Like, that was something that these highly resilient men and women shared in common. So what if we had race dialogues or dialogues about heterosexism and homophobia that started with people saying, yeah, I think it's hard for me because the story I make up when you say I have privilege is that I didn't work hard for what I have. Because that is the story people make up when you talk to them about privilege. And when you can come back and say, yeah, I could see how that would cause a lot of pain, especially when, you know, you did come from nothing, you worked your way up. But that's not what I'm talking about when I talk about straight privilege or white privilege or whatever privilege I'm talking about. That is such a disarming way to lead with vulnerability. I don't know what the truth is, but I can tell you what I'm telling myself. You know, and so to me, that has ramifications beyond personal work.
Now, just to bring in the spiritual dimension here to the rumble process, I was reading in Rising Strong, and at one point you talked about praying during a rumble that you were going through. And I thought, that's really interesting. That's a different resource. And I wonder if you can talk more about that, and if you're in a difficult rumble, how you might pray, what that's like for you.
Yeah, that's, my prayer is embrace the suck. Like I'm speaking.
Does it go beyond that?
I'm speaking directly to God when I say that. Like, I am like, oh yeah, I'm a praying person. I am definitely a please, 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 thank you prayer. But I am also a PG-13 prayer. Yeah. When I'm in the middle of a hard rumble and I'm like, this is bullshit. This is just bullshit. I'm so sick of him acting this way. This is just bullshit. That's how Diana taught me to pray, my therapist. She said, just get alone so you don't take anyone down. And you're going to have to do that. People pray in all different ways, right? I'm not a God, I'm in deep struggle and I'm feeling a lot of discomfort and anger and I want a peaceful heart. That's the subtext of what I'm saying.
Not the text.
But not the text. No. And so to me, that's probably the get alone, be alone. That and music. And so music is the thinnest place for me in my life. And so if I can also like put a song on or do something that gets me to a thin place. Music is a thin place, but the other thin place is just alone and giving myself permission to be enraged or scared about something. That's what prayer is for me.
Prayer seems to imply there's a dialogue of some kind going on. So help me understand your understanding of your dialogue partner, if you will, when you're praying.
It was funny because the other day someone said, they were asking me, I was doing something at the Jung Center in Houston. It was about my relationship with God, the history of my relationship with God. And so I talked about leaving church at some point. And I remember he said, was it hard to leave God? And I was like, oh, no, God came with me. Like, God wasn't going to stay in that thing either. like, no. And so I it's not a hard area for me. Like, do you know what the Daily Examine is?
No.
I think is it St. Ignatius? This Daily Examine prayer. It's a Catholic kind of thing where you talk about what did you feel yesterday? What do you want to try to change? And at the end of it, you always talk about God within, God between, and God among us. And so I really feel like when I'm my dialogue partner, when I'm like, this is bullshit, this really, I'm so pissed. Am I pissed? Embrace the suck. I feel like God is saying, yes, that's bullshit. Yes. That's total bullshit. Embrace the suck. Yes. Yes. And then when I'm done, I'm like, okay, I think my feelings are hurt. And God's like, yeah. I think that's right. Your feelings are hurt. And so I think if my intentions are in love and belonging, going back to that definition, and I'm trying to fuel connection and not, disrupt it, I think what's inside of me in that process is holy enough for me. I think God's with me in that. I feel like the process itself is holy. I'm trying to make a commitment that is deeply spiritual in my mind to feel my pain rather than cause pain.
Mm-hmm.
To own my hurt rather than hurt other people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not good at that. In this world, we are much better at causing pain than we are feeling pain. And we hurt others more than we own our own hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think by definition, that is a spiritual practice.
Because
mm-hmm. it is rooted in my belief that I can't take this hurt and put it on you and be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're hurt and I'm hurting you, I'm hurting me too.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is to do something with the pain that makes it better for both of us. And so I don't think God's counting the curse words in my prayers.
Mm-hmm.
We got bigger fish to fry.
Yeah.
Ha, no pun intended. That's funny.
That's right.
That was funny. Yeah. I just wanted to let y'all know y'all can laugh because that was funny. Fish metaphor, get it?
Now, in the rumble aspect of the process,
yes.
The hardest questions we received were people who are grieving, deep griefs.
Yeah.
Someone wrote, my mom died 10 years ago. My grief is deep and oozing out. How do I do the work of grieving? And you talked about how grief, like shame, is one of those emotions that's not readily welcome in our culture at large. It's put under things. What do you have to say about helping people grieve and also changing the cultural climate around grief?
I think we grieve together and we heal together. And I do not think there is a mode of healing more powerful around grief work than group work.
Mm-hmm.
Therapeutic group work around grief.
Yeah.
And I think that there's grief, and then there's a page in the back of Rising Strong where I define what complicated grief is, the kind of grief that still defines behavior, and I give some resources. That work we should be doing with someone.
Mm-hmm.
That work rearranges our lives. All grief rearranges our lives. But there can be a level of grief where we can't get back to even a new normal.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that work alone.
Yeah.
No one can do that work alone. The person who invented the word complicated grief in his or her own grief cannot do that work alone. That is not about intellectual prowess, grit, determination, toughness, resilience. That's about doing the work. And let me tell you, I've done focus group with bereavement therapists and grief therapists. They make the special ops people look easy. These are tough people.
Yeah.
Not tough like knock your socks off, but that is tough work. That is work on the very far edges of love, like the rough edges of love. So I would say, if you're still sad and you still feel a longing and a sense of loss around the death of a parent, the death of someone significant in your life, that feels healthy and normal to me. And I don't know that we should pathologize that. If it's getting in the way of your love and your life and you're feeling alive, I think you get help.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's weakness. I think that's you know, mm-hmm. a big price